were just in committee, very recently. I had scheduled this so that we would start with the energy facility siting bill and move through around 7:30, move to Senate Bill 593, and then around 7:45, move to the other two bills. But apparently Representative Witt would like to testify on Senate Bill 659, that he won't be able to if we wait until 7:45 to do that. And we would certainly want to accommodate that. So let's go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 659. Representative Witt, if you'd like to come up. What do you have to go after this?
To fossil, Mr. Chairman.
Fossil, okay, well, you're on the move.
The Information Management and Technology Committee will be having field hearings over there. For the record, I'm Brad Witt, House District 31. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, certainly appreciate the courtesy of being able to testify here this morning in advance of the general public comments. Forests are vital to the state of Oregon for many reasons. They contribute to our sense of place and state character. They have a defining role in creating and maintaining diverse, dynamic ecosystems. They possess beauties and mysteries to be enjoyed by the public. They generate products that are critical to human welfare. They purify our air and water. They refresh the spiritual nature of mankind. They are the source of employment for tens of thousands of Oregonians. They are renewable when well managed, and all of these are important. The multiple uses of our forests, including no use at all for some areas, must always be balanced to ensure sustainability, environmentally, socially, and economically. The role of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute in supporting sustainable forestry has been indispensable, scientifically based, and accepted in most quarters. They have provided state-of-the-art research, best practices, and statewide education promoting sound forest management for several years now. In 2004, OFRI published a study entitled Oregon Forest Sector Contributions and Potential, the first major economic study of the forest sector in over 10 years, indicating that forests have and will contribute significantly to the economy of our state. The study concluded that Oregon must remain on the leading edge of wood products innovation. Competitive forest products development, and education and training of a world-class workforce. All of this is to be accomplished while our state continues its leadership in scientifically appropriate forest management. OFRI recently conducted a survey among family woodland owners, a highly important segment of Oregon's total forest ownership, that indicated their continuing need for first-rate information on such key forest management topics as fire hazard reduction, control of invasive plants, control of insects, and identification and control of disease, all of which OFRI has been in a position to supply. This has been made possible through their collaboration with the OSU College of Forestry, our community colleges, and federal agencies. Part of OFRI's mission has been to save and enhance our forest heritage through the education of young Oregonians. Through its programs for K-12 teachers and students, its Oregon Garden Rediscovery Forest Project, and multiple other efforts around the state, 13,000 students and 2,100 teachers in 2004 learned about the value of our forests, the wonder of our watersheds, and the necessity of promoting scientifically proven forest management activities. Additionally, OFRI has tried to incorporate many points of view about the use of our forests, including those of the timber industry. Small woodland owners, academia, and various members of the environmental community, including Oregon Trout's Healthy Waters Institute, Sustainable Northwest, the Nature Conservancy, Oregon Wildlife Heritage Foundation, and the Oregon Environmental Council. OFRI receives no general fund dollars. Dollars earmarked from the forest products harvest tax to fund OFRI are not available for general fund usage. As a former OFRI board member, it is my opinion that an attempt by the legislature to utilize these dedicated funds for any purposes other than those for which they were intended would result in OFRI's portion of this tax being zeroed out, OFRI being defunded, and the loss to our state of this scientifically based internationally recognized forest research institute. The funds that flow to OFRI from the forest products harvest tax are well spent in terms of our understanding, utilization, and protection of one of our state's leading economic engines. I urge your opposition to Senate Bill 659. Thank you very much.
Questions from the committee?
Thank you very much. Good luck in getting to fossil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 659. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 527. Senator Morissette and Senator Whitsett, would you like to come up and testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Springfield, parts of Lane and Linn County, I do represent the Coburg area where the gas-fired power plant has been negotiated over the last 5 years or so. I met with the last owner, Gary Marcus, twice to talk about how he was going to get the necessary permits, the water permit. There's been a lot of opposition in terms of water rights. There's been some concern about the drift of the emissions going against the Coburg Hills. And those of you who drive I-5, when you get west or north of Eugene, the Coburg Hills off to the right, there's a fog bank. There's always a fog bank against the Coburg Hills. That's the prevailing wind, and everything just kind of collects there. The siting council, I guess, is...
I think it might be helpful just give like a 30-second on what the bill does.
Okay. I'm going to end there, except I will say that there was an article in the Oregonian Sunday talking about the acid rain in the gorge. I'm concerned about the rules of siting. I think they have to take in the local concerns more than they are presently doing. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Whitsett.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Senator Doug Whitsett, representing Senate District 28, including Klamath County, where the Cobb facility would be located. This testimony is given on behalf of Mr. Ed Sullivan, a land use lawyer with Garvey, Schubert, and Bear. Mr. Sullivan represents our Save Our Rural Oregon and is currently appealing the case to the Oregon Supreme Court. Mr. Sullivan writes regarding Senate Bill 527, "Dear Senators, we are writing to encourage adoption of Senate Bill 527 as proposed by Senators Whitsett, Morissette, and Representatives Garrard and Barnhart. This bill, which amends portions of OS 469.310 through 469.504 regulating issuance of the site certificates for energy generation, will put land use review authority back where it should be, in the hands of local government. For the reasons set forth below, Saul and his members request that you endorse this bill. Save Our Rural Oregon is an organization comprised of neighboring farms and other interested citizens fighting to stop the construction of the Cobb Energy Facility on rural farm land in Klamath County. The Cobb facility structure will expand over 50 acres of previously productive farmland. The size and scale of the structure proposed is much larger than any other building in the vicinity and larger than most of the structures in nearby urban areas such as the city of Klamath Falls. The structure will include two large smokestacks that will be visible from miles away. Facility operations will result in the emissions of significant amounts of carbon dioxide into the air that will not only have a negative impact on the long-term productivity of the environment as a significant contributor to global warming, but may cause health problems to nearby residents as well. SAR has worked ceaselessly over the past 2 years to fight the Cobb by convincing the Oregon Department of Energy and the Energy Facility Siting Council to take a closer look at the negative impacts resulting from the Cobb proposal, especially as they relate to environment and land use regulations. When considering compliance with the land use laws, OS 469.504, as it is currently drafted, allows the applicant to elect whether to demonstrate compliance with the land use laws before the local government or before FSEC. Should the applicant elect to have FSEC provide the land use review, a convoluted and ambiguous series of compliance criteria for approval follow. First, OS 469.5045 allows FSEC to be the sole determiner of which local standards or criteria apply to the proposed application. ESSEC has no obligation to share its list of relevant criteria with the public, nor defend its conclusions regarding whether the criteria are applicable. Further, OS 469.5041B, setting forth when the local regulations, statewide planning goals and rules, or the special ESSEC land use exceptions apply, could not be any less clear. To date, ESSEC has taken the position that it may apply and determine compliance based on arbitrary selection of local regulations, statewide land use goals, and ESSEC exceptions. This approach is inconsistent with the plain language of the statute, which uses the word or rather than and in setting forth how goal compliance can be achieved. Moreover, ESSEC's approach exemplifies that it does not understand the policy framework of Oregon land use law, and in fact explicitly rejects Oregon's accepted approach to land use. Statewide land use goal and exceptions fall out once the local government achieves acknowledgement that its local standards are consistent with the goals. The goals and exceptions cannot be inserted into place of a local regulation if the local regulation cannot be satisfied. The local government is charged with applying and interpreting its own regulations. Oregon's local government has always been an essential part of the land use development approval process. Over this time, local governments have gained specialized expertise and knowledge in the area of land use. Local governments draft their own comprehensive plans and land use ordinances and make land use decisions interpreting those standards. It makes little sense to take land use decisions out of these local forums and put them before an agency whose expertise is energy generation and not land use. Senate Bill 527 puts the land use decision-making power back in the hands of the local government. Like many other agencies, approvals that require land use compatibility sign-off from the local government before a permit can be issued, this bill requires that the facility obtain local land use approval before a facility siting permit can be issued by ESSEC. This approach ensures that the local government representatives are politically responsible for development within their local jurisdictions. Further, it eliminates much of the current confusion in existing statute that allows ESSEC to pick and choose which standards to apply. For these reasons, we hope that you will support Senate Bill 527. Local governments are uniquely qualified to provide land use review of energy facilities. You should acknowledge this expertise and put the power of land use review back in the local government's hands. Please include this letter as part of the legislative record for this bill. Sincerely, Save Our Rural Oregon. Chairman Ringo and members of the committee, I want to read you a statement taken directly from the ESSEC website on the siting process for energy facilities. Quote, the council's decision is binding on all state and local agencies whose permits are addressed in the council's review. These agencies must issue necessary permits and licenses subject only to the conditions adopted by the council. End of quote. The council can and does force local and state agencies to issue permits or licenses regardless of the advice or the objections of those local state agencies. The manner in which the council conditions those permits and licenses is not constrained by local ordinance, state statute, or administrative rule. This fact is confirmed by the words and actions of the ESSEC members, the department staff, and the Department of Justice lawyers on the official record of the Cobb siting hearing. That absolute power is, in large part, conceded by SAR lawyers. The council's authority is absolute. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 527 to the Senate chamber. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, there are two sets of amendments that we've been given this morning. I was wondering if these come from the senators who sponsored the bill. There are two sets of amendments that we were handed out this morning on the bill. I was wondering if they come from the senators who sponsored the bill.
I think our committee administrator might have the answer here.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, the dash threes are what we're up to now, and that's what everyone's agreed with? Okay.
All right. It sounds like that Senator Morissette's nodding that the dash three amendments are the ones you'd like proposed. Okay.
Yes.
Senator Whitson, I had a question. There's a lot of reasons why this bill makes sense to me, that communities ought to be able to plan what happens in their communities with respect to something as significant as an energy facility, but... And I don't recall the discussions where the initial statute was put into place. I think Senator Beyer may have been part of that. But I'm wondering if you don't have some supersiding authority, whether every community says not in our town, and so it becomes nearly impossible to locate an energy facility.
Chair Ringo, I believe that's a legitimate concern. The current paradigm has simply gone too far in the other way. I don't think, I can speak for my wife and I, and I think many others in this room, that we do not oppose power plants. But the siting of this plant in the manner in which it has been done, in my opinion, Senator, local input was totally ignored.
Mm-hmm.
Local public safety, geologic hazard, water law, land use law was just simply ignored. And I find it difficult to accept that we have a appointed commission that is dictating what's going to happen in our communities and apparently totally devoid of any control short of review to the Supreme Court.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
We have some folks who came some distance for this from Klamath County, William Brock and Marilyn Lynn Brock, please.
I'd like to grab her.
If time is limited, could we have people from Lane County?
Certainly.
Go ahead.
Ready? Okay. I guess we'll go.
Mrs. Brisnan, grab that camera and I'll take a picture.
Go ahead.
Thanks.
I've already my name is Malin Brock. We live in Bonanza, Oregon, which is the location where the Cobb facility, one of the largest power plants in the world, is proposed to be sited. As Senator Whitsitt said, there have been many concerns because of the way the process has been handled. It's been very frustrating for all of us. Even when we found legal points that should have been addressed, the process has supersiding authority and they kind of roll over the top of everyone and it's being pushed through anyway. I already emailed my written comments to you, so I'm just going to make a couple brief comments. One is that one of the main concerns is that this facility and I believe the Coburg and Turner facilities are being proposed on exclusive farm use land. That was zoned that way for a reason. It should not be a location for a huge industrial facility.
Do you have any?
We can't even get a straight answer out of the Department of Energy. Someplace between 50 and 150 acres, depending on which appurtenant facilities they're talking about. They're having a 7.3-mile-long transmission line. They had thought they could cut right into the main intertie lines right there under the line. They say they've got an option to purchase 2,700 acres, and they're doing this because they're playing games to try and keep the noise issue at a distance. We've talked to those landowners. They do not have an option to do this.
Thank you.
We would certainly prefer to see solar-powered or wind-powered or hydrothermal-powered facilities if they are going to put it on EFU land. Those are types of energy facilities that would not be as harmful to a farming community. I'll stop my comments so there's more time for others.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Bill Brock. My wife and I farm in Lanjo Valley. I prepared a short statement because this is a very emotional thing with me. I've wanted this ranch for many years, worked on the west side to try and get it. And now I'm there and they want to put this power plant out my front windows. I travel here today to express my support for Senate Bill 527. I believe that this bill provides a first step in a much-needed reform of our state's energy facility siting standards. For more than 2 years now, I have studied the state policy used for siting power plants. I have learned that the public protections set forth by the legislature as far back as 1973 have been circumvented by industry lobbyists and our own energy department. Under the guise of addressing a long-forgotten pending crisis, the alarmists have outshouted the public and stolen the public process of siting energy facilities. Every past energy crisis has been the result of market manipulation. From the rush to build nuclear power plants in the 60s, the gas crisis of the 70s, to the California rolling blackouts of 2001, and all energy scares in between were industry-initiated. Later this morning, the State Energy Department and industry lobbyists will imply that we need to keep the state statutes as they are because we are very near another energy shortage, and only they know what's best for Oregon. The state continues to ignore the published predictions of the California Independent System Operator, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and the White Book of the Bonneville Power Administration, all major players in the West Coast power market. All three predict adequate power for the foreseeable future, even during this coming short water year. There has never been need to fast-track energy facility siting. Senate Bill 527 would return a small portion of the public scrutiny that was silently removed during the 90s. Oregonians want clean power, not another fossil fueled behemoth. Oregonians want a say in when and where power facilities will be built. Senate Bill 527 would return some much-needed public involvement to the energy facility siting process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. What's the potential schedule of this? If the legislature does nothing and this moves forward under current schedule?
Right now, the plant in our neighborhood is going before the Oregon Supreme Court. So it's out of...
pending that decision.
There's nothing that... This bill 527 would be helpful for anybody in the future.
I see.
We're past that point on the Cobb plant.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
They would have broken ground probably a year ago if we hadn't slowed the process down, and our appeal is being filed next week to the Oregon Supreme Court. And I would like to say that we are here representing hundreds or thousands of people in Klamath Falls who have supported this financially, this fight against the Cobb.
Well, I appreciate your taking the energy to come all the way from Klamath Falls up here to Salem, and that's commendable, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Whitsitt. You know, I didn't realize. No, come on up forward, please. I didn't realize that you were on this list. I would have had you testify with your husband the first time. Sorry about that.
My name is Gail Whitsitt. I reside at 23131 North Po Valley Road, Klamath Falls, Oregon. Good morning, Chairman Ringo and committee members. I'm here today to testify regarding the overly broad Oregon Department of Energy's process for siting gas-fired electrical generating plants. My experience comes from a two-year ordeal of dealing with this exceedingly powerful department while they have permitted the California-Oregon border plant. This massive 1,160-megawatt facility will be located on EFU-zoned agricultural lands in a rural area of Klamath County. As a multi-degree geologist who attended both OSU and Princeton University with many years of professional experience, I've been both shocked and dismayed at the overreaching powers afforded the Department of Energy in this state. In my own experience, the department routinely exceeded statutory authority regarding the seismicity and geologic findings of the power plant site, as well as the land use zoning in the area. In my professional geologic opinion, the site, which directly overlies a 10-mile-long, massive normal fault with over 2,000 feet of vertical displacement, has not been properly assessed according to OAR 345-022-0020. In other words, the Department of Energy allowed the applicant, People's Energy of Chicago, to skip compliance with parts of the structural standard section of the law and sited the plant over the fault without adequately characterizing the site for seismicity and ground motion. The department and the applicant have consistently dismissed the law. They have stated that because this process was previously undertaken at another plant, Hermiston Generating Facility, and because they did not follow the statute at that site, there is now precedent to repeat the violation of statute wherever and whenever they choose. Perhaps I am old-fashioned, but I believe that we have laws for a reason, and in this case it is for the public safety. The department's reason for avoidance of compliance with Oregon law was that People's Energy alleged that it was too expensive to determine whether the site was geologically appropriate before siting, as the law states, before siting. As a result of this allegation, the department agreed to mitigate the law and try to determine whether the site was appropriate after the plant was sited. This is worse than backward thinking. It is, quite frankly, in violation of Oregon law. This case is now scheduled for review by the Oregon Supreme Court, where the structural standard requirement violation is a primary part of this case. And if you need in the future, I can tell you the part of the contested case where they actually agree with my opinions on this. A similar process of mitigating Oregon water law was exercised by the Department of Energy. The department provided People's Energy a groundwater permit in an aquifer where more than 35 farmers and ranchers have groundwater drought permits. Some of these ranchers have waited for more than 10 years for these drought permits to be confirmed in a water right certificate. Yet by applying mitigating conditions to the People's Energy certificate, the department provided the company with a secure water source in direct contradiction to Oregon and Western water law. When directly asked on the record for the statutory authority for this mitigation, the Department of Justice response was that technically there is no statutory authority, but that because such authority does exist in the Deschutes River watershed, they would simply do it in the Lost River watershed as well. The entire Bonanza subbasin may have their irrigation wells shut down due to a lack of groundwater, yet this massive facility will still have the right to keep pumping groundwater from the same aquifer. In siting this plant, the department violated or manipulated virtually every land use regulation regarding exclusive farm use. The applicant alleged that the selected site was unique because it was near the intersection of high voltage transmission lines, a high pressure natural gas line, and a previously untapped groundwater aquifer. It was alleged that this uniqueness authorized breaching the EFU land use regulations. However, as the siting process developed, the allegation that the groundwater source was a previously untapped aquifer was proven false by Oregon Water Resources Department and U.S. Geological Survey hydrologists. The proximity to the high voltage transmission lines was irrelevant because the applicant was not allowed by BPA to access those lines near the site. In fact, the applicant agreed to build 7 miles of high-voltage transmission lines in order to deliver their electricity to the nearest BPA substation at an additional cost of $44 million. The only uniqueness in the proximity to the natural gas transmission line is the proximity to the pressure booster Bonanza pumping station that will allow People's Energy to use natural gas to fire its turbines without recompressing the gas. This uniqueness is economic at best. In spite of the foregoing commonly known facts and in clear violation of Oregon land use law, the Energy Facility Siting Council voted unanimously to site the plant in the EFU location due to its uniqueness of the site. Because of the supersiting powers afforded the Department of Energy by the legislature in the past, they are now an out-of-control department who will answer to no one. They simply mitigate and then condition any laws that stand in the way of siting. They then cite the illegal action for precedent at subsequent siting locations. This is a truly dangerous path to go down. The Oregon Department of Energy is well on the way to practicing a totalitarian or authoritarian method of government. This department's total disregard for Oregon statutes and for its citizens has been one of the most frustrating experiences I have encountered in a professional capacity, working on projects with both state and federal governments. I'm asking you in your capacity as legislators to rein in this agency and limit or remove the supersiding powers of the Department of Energy and the Energy Facility Siting Council. Also, for the record, I am not opposed to gas-fired electrical generating plants sited within the confines of the law and located in appropriate areas as defined by Oregon land use laws. I am educated and practice professionally as a petroleum geologist for Standard Oil of Ohio and British Petroleum Amoco. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important matter and for your time and consideration.
Thank you. I really appreciate your testimony. I just wanted to ask a couple questions in clarification. I have not studied this issue in any depth. I had assumed that they need the rationale for siting the facility there was in proximity to the transmission line. I think the DC intertie, I think it's called. Was that a rationale for siting it there? And your testimony indicates that it was not a valid rationale.
That's correct. The entire reason that they gave for siting this was that in this location, so that it essentially violated or exceeded the laws that are allowed for the amount of EFU land that can come out, was because they said it was on a new aquifer. There were these things, you know, and it was the pumping station and where you could tie in the lines with BPA and a new aquifer. And as it turns out, two of the three things weren't true at all.
Well, just focusing on the connection to the DC line. To your knowledge, could this have been sited in many places in Oregon as long as it was close to, say, a BPA substation?
Yes, that's my understanding. Right. What they were trying to do, it was economic to place it here because it was near the gas pipeline. And so the person that came in and talked to us from People's Energy said that they chose this for these reasons, but in fact two of the reasons weren't true at all.
Okay, and on the water mitigation issue, how much water will the facility use?
It's not a large amount. It originally was going to be a water-cooled facility, and then Water for Life and a group of people essentially went to court and threatened to sue to have it changed, and so they changed it to an air-cooled. Had we not been there, this thing would have taken about two-thirds of the Horsefly Irrigation District water for the ranchers out there. So it is smaller. They changed it. It's not as much water, but the reality is that they can have water when no one else can have water because they moved to the head of the permit process.
I guess I want to understand that a little bit better. Your testimony says by applying mitigating conditions. How did that work?
Maybe I could ask Senator Whitsitt to...
Okay. Yeah, you could. Thank you. Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you, Chair Ringo. Essentially, what they did was there's about 35... drought-permitted irrigation wells that have never been certificated in that area, and they may not be because of a groundwater insufficiency problem. What the FSEC did was to give the issue the Cobb's plant a certificate, and in before addressing the 35 wells, and they did this by writing conditions that would mitigate any injury to the other well users. And that mitigation probably will prevent any other damage, but that is not the point. It violates Western water law, the priority first in use, first in right. And if that type of mitigation is allowed to stand, Senator Ringo, we have just made water rights available to the highest bidder.
Mm-hmm.
It completely abrogates Western water law and Oregon water law.
Okay. Senator Atkinson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Let's hear from the other side on this. Richard Allen, please, and Mike Graney. Mr. Allen, are you representing the other side of this?
I'm representing Portland General Electric, but I think I've been selected as the person who will speak for energy facility developers.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Richard Allen. I'm a partner with Baljanic LLP in Portland. My practice focuses on environmental and land use law, and I've been working on energy facility siting matters for over 10 years. I'm here today on behalf of Portland General Electric Company. A written statement is being distributed to you. I want to focus my testimony first on what the energy facility siting process is like in Oregon today. Next, talk a little bit about how land use fits into that, because my understanding of this bill is that the principal point of the bill is to take the land use process out of siting council's hands and put it in local government's hands. And finally, I might touch briefly on the issue of need for power, which is also addressed in the bill. Oregon's energy facility siting law is based on the premise that siting energy facilities is an issue of statewide concern. It's also based on the reality that siting many types of energy facilities involves issues that cross local jurisdictional lines. A typical energy facility will be located on a generating facility will be located on a particular piece of property in a particular zone, but it will have natural gas pipeline laterals, water supply laterals, wastewater discharge laterals, and transmission lines that may pass through many zones and many different jurisdictions. I recently have been working with Portland General Electric on siting the Port Westward Generating Facility. It's located on industrially zoned exception land owned by the Port of St. Helens along the Columbia River in Columbia County. But it has transmission line that passes through other zones under county jurisdiction and through the city of Rainier. It involves more than one land use jurisdiction, and that's one of the reasons why you have this ability to go to the siting council for land use approval.
Mr. Allen, if I could ask you a question about this specific facility. It's called a COB facility.
Yes, I will say I do not represent the developers of any of the three projects you've heard mentioned, COB, the Coburg or West Cascades project, or the Turner project. I'm happy to try and answer questions because I do at least have some familiarity with what's going on.
On the one down in the Klamath Falls area,
right.
Is there any reason that needed to be sited in that general area, or if it was just putting energy into the general grid, could it have been placed anywhere in Oregon for that purpose?
I wouldn't say it could be placed anywhere in Oregon, Mr. Chair. In order to site a natural gas-fired power plant, you need to have essentially three things: proximity to natural gas, proximity to high-capacity electric transmission lines, and water, and some place to discharge the water. But you know, those are the general constraints. So there are many places in the state where you could not possibly site a facility because you don't have proximity to one or more of those. And proximity is a relative concept. Port Westward is 10 miles from a BPA substation, but it's right next to an interstate gas pipeline, the KB pipeline, and obviously right next to the Columbia River and the Port of St. Helens as a water right. You need to be close to those things, but you may not need to be right on top of all three.
Yeah, go ahead with your testimony. Thank you.
What the siting process leads to is the issuance of a site certificate. And you heard some testimony that, on the Energy Facility Siting Council's website, it says this is binding on all state agencies and local governments. And that's absolutely right. Why is that the case? Because the legislature made it the case. That's what the law provides. The site certificate is more than just a permit. It's a contract between the energy facility developer and the state. The developer has to comply with the conditions of the site certificate. State and local governments have to issue the permits that are covered by the site certificate. The site certificate for the Port Westward Generating Facility is, I think, about 75 pages with attachments. Those 75 pages are essentially all conditions of approval, and it was a non-controversial project. The siting process does not, however, cover all permits. It includes local land use approvals if the developer chooses what we call Path B, using the siting council to make land use determinations. It covers state agency permits that are issued under state law, but it does not cover any permits issued by federal agencies or permits issued by state or local or regional government under federally delegated programs. You heard, I think, with respect to several of these facilities, concerns about air quality impacts. The Siting Council doesn't have any authority to regulate those air quality impacts or to issue the air contaminant discharge permit. That is done in most of the state by the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and for the Coburg facility that you heard about, also called the West Cascades Project, that permit will be issued by the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority. So the Siting Council doesn't have a role in making determinations about what the air quality impacts of a facility are or whether it qualifies for a permit. I also found it somewhat odd that since this bill is focused on shifting land use authority to the local government, you heard a lot of testimony about alleged violations of, you know, Oregon water law. Well, in the case of that COB project, the State Department of Energy works very closely with other state agencies, and the water right application was reviewed very carefully by the Oregon Water Resources Department, and the determination that there wouldn't be any violation of Oregon water law and that the water right could be issued was on recommendation of the Water Resources Department. It's not a rogue Department of Energy that's making that determination. If I could touch briefly on why land use why I think the current system works in terms of land use. When a client comes to me and says, should we use Path A and go to local government, or should we use Path B and have the Siting Council make a determination on land use, we generally tell them, use Path B. The reasons are fairly straightforward. First, the Siting Council process already involves many of the same issues that you will face in a local land use proceeding. Why have two proceedings that are addressing the same kinds of issues about public health and safety, impacts on public facilities and services, impacts on important resources like fish and wildlife habitat, soil and water, wetlands, when it's already going to be addressed under the Siting Council standards in the state process? Next, as I already mentioned, you often have projects, in fact, it's probably more the rule than the exception, that projects involve multiple land use jurisdictions. The Port Westward project involved two jurisdictions, but I can't even imagine something like Northwest Natural South Mist Feeder, South Mist Extension, trying to get approval from every single local government, county and city government, that pipeline passed through. So a needed public facility would end up in the situation where local governments are saying, well, we want it moved there, and a different local government says, we want it moved there, and pretty soon you find you can't site it anywhere. There's also the potential with local land use proceedings and the Siting Council process that you can end up with inconsistent decisions. Projects also change during the siting process. Quite frequently, they change significantly, as you heard with the COB project. They went from a water-cooled project to an air-cooled project. Well, that's not just a change in water use. You have to increase the size of the facility to make it an air-cooled project. That would have an impact on land use decision-making. If you've already gone through the local land use approval, at the time you decide that we're going to make it an air-cooled project, you're going back through the local process. There's some concern about the Siting Council being a fast-track process. It's not. From a complete application to final decision, statute requires the Siting Council to make a decision within 9 months. If it doesn't, there really isn't a consequence. You can't go to court and order that your site certificate be issued. Compare that with local land use law.
if a local government gets this hulking application from the energy facility developer and the application is complete, by statute, that local government has to decide the case, reach a final decision within 120 days, 4 months instead of 9 months. And what happens if they don't? The applicant can go to circuit court, get a mandamus action, and order that the land use approval be issued. This may be a situation where local opponents of projects may find that if they get what they wished, they may wish they didn't have it. A final note is that you've heard that the Siting Council essentially ran roughshod over people. I understand that the Siting Council process is more involved and probably daunting for some local opponents of projects. It's not as comfortable as going in front of your local planning commissioner, your local board of county commissioners. But to say that they ran roughshod, for instance, in the case of the COB project, the problem there is the local government is appointed by state statute as a special advisory group to the Siting Council. So the local government has a duty to advise the Siting Council on what standards should be applied and to make recommendations about whether the project satisfies local land use standards and whether the project should have any conditions put on to comply with local land use standards. My experience has been when the local government takes that action, the Department of Energy generally follows the local government's recommendations. In the case of the COB project, however, it's my understanding that the Klamath County Board of Commissioners did not submit comments to the Siting Council as in its role as a special advisory group. In that situation, I'm not sure what else the Siting Council can do. But one thing you also lose if you go to a situation of purely local review of land.
Excuse me, if you could just wrap it up
for
a minute, please. Thank you.
I will, Mr. Chair. When our projects go to the Siting Council for land use review, they also get reviewed for land use approval not only by Department of Energy staff and county staff, they get reviewed by the Oregon Department of Justice attorneys. The same attorneys who advise the Land Conservation and Development Commission review the land use analysis for a power plant that goes through Siting Council approval. So I guess I find it questionable when I hear opponents of a project say that the Department of Energy has no understanding of Oregon land use law, when the fact of the matter is some of the attorneys who have the best understanding of Oregon land use law have reviewed these applications, and quite frankly, in my experience, their review of the land use analysis for an energy facility application is, if anything, more exacting than any local government review. I think that's the reality of the process. The fact that one project...
Could just wrap it up, please, Mr. Allen.
One project is in front of the Oregon Supreme Court. The Coburg project is early in the application process, and the local government or the local opponents haven't even really had the chance to comment on the application because it's not complete. And the Turner project that you heard mentioned is, as I understand it, essentially dead. I would ask that you not change this statute based on one unsatisfactory outcome on one power plant.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mike, go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike Rainey, Director of the Department of Energy. I'm glad to be here this morning. I'll just give a few brief remarks because I know you have other witnesses and other bills. I'd be happy to come back and answer questions in more detail. I'm providing two handouts. The first is an overview of the siting process and a list of projects both pending and that have been approved by the Siting Council in recent years. A Siting Council is a seven-person citizen panel appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. They're independent. They make their decisions based on an on-the-record contested case hearing process after a technical review that we do as their staff and full participation by any parties that want to participate. It's an extensive process. Many of the applicants have called it exhausting and exhaustive. And grueling. We have the Siting Council has adopted a set of standards that fills a large notebook. comprehensive set of standards for environmental and safety review. I guess I would say, while I understand the concerns and the strong feelings of people who haven't agreed with the recent decision on the Cobb plant or the CLD plant, we followed the law. We followed the law that, you've established. You have established a centralized siting process. We do try to make it as responsive to both individuals and local governments as possible. We're one of the few agencies that allows individuals to not only represent themselves if they can't afford an attorney, but also represent organizations, local organizations, citizens of organizations, without an attorney in our process. And of course, they're welcome to have an attorney as well. Let me mention just briefly a couple of things on, the three
now
projects.
If you could wrap it up quickly. We're way behind schedule here. I'm sorry.
Okay. Oregon is a net importer of energy, even with the facilities that have been sited. And we get power and sell power throughout the region, including we buy power from California in the Northwest. I think you have a fundamental choice of, are you going to have a state siting process that's centralized, or do you have individual state and local agency decisions? If you go with a process of multiple agencies, and it's difficult to site power plants here, my concern is not that we'll have renewable resources instead of natural gas, but the developers who are going to develop natural gas will develop coal. They'll develop coal in the mountain states, and the type of haze that was of concern in the front page of the Oregonian article that Senator Morissette pointed out to you, we'll see more of, not less, if this bill passes in its current form. We have suggested some amendments in response to Senator Morissette's request. We try to give local governments a more enhanced role. I have copies of those available. It still leaves the decision with the state. That's a difficult issue to balance one way or the other, and frankly, the reaction to these amendments from everybody on all sides has been blah.
Okay.
But they're here if you'd like them.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate your testimony. I'd like to ask the last three people on this issue to come up, and I really apologize. You're going to need to be brief, though. Jim Thompson, Lisa Arkin, John Sundquist. I had said we were going to take a half hour for this hearing. Well, it's almost an hour, and so I'm going to ask you to be brief. Certainly, we're not going to be passing any bill today. But, yeah, come on up, please.
Chairman Ringo, members of the committee, can I
what's your name, please?
My name is John Sundquist, and
yes.
Can I exceed or give my time to Roger Hamilton, previous...
Oh, yes, I didn't mention Roger Hamilton, but yeah, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Sundquist. I will note that. Mr. Hamilton, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Ringo, members of the committee. Excuse me, I ran down to plug the meter. I don't usually fill it at 6:30 in the morning here. My name is Jim Thompson. I'm the mayor of the city of Turner. I've passed out written testimony, and I'm not going to read that to you this morning. You can all read. I'll try to give you a brief synopsis. I would like to point out something, however. Turner is one of these considerations, and in fact, tomorrow, in Turner, the Energy Siting Council is to make a decision on the Calpine application, which has been in process for over 3.5 years, and a moment ago you heard testimony that by law they have to complete these matters within 9 months. Well, I would submit to you, gentlemen, that the Turner matter has been going on since October of, they closed in October of 2003, they issued the proposed draft order in March of 2005. That is substantially longer than the 9 months that you heard the attorney allude to as statute. We are dealing with the Calpine matter in Turner. I'm not going to get into all the ramifications. You can read my testimony. I would like to point out a couple of things, however. We were named as a special advisory group on the matter, along with Marion County. In March of 2003, I wrote a letter as an interested and concerned citizen to the department, and I want to share with you two of the responses I got back. And my letter entailed our rules, our land use rules, because they simply will not accommodate the proposed Calpine facility. And I was told, at no point in the review process for the proposed TEC must Calpine or the Energy Facility Siting Council seek any land use approvals from the Turner Planning Commission or the Turner City Council. The Turner City Council serves only in an advisory role for this process. Further in that letter, Energy wrote, again, the Energy Facility Siting Council will make all land use decisions on the proposed TEC, including the final decision about whether the project qualifies for expedited review, and any decision will otherwise be determined by the Turner Planning Commission. I will submit to you, gentlemen, that we comply with the regulations of Chapter 469, ORS 469, as far as our land use rules are concerned. I would further submit that a city or jurisdiction of our nature should be able to determine what kind of facilities we want built within our boundaries, and we have determined that large electrical generation plants are not something we're interested in.
You want some control over your community, Mr.?
Most assuredly, sir, we do. Okay. And we've done that with our land use rules that have been in place before Calpine came to Turner and made its application. We've reviewed them and renewed them subsequent to that time. We say that Oregon is a home rule state, and home jurisdiction should be able to have a say in what they want cited within their boundaries. Okay. I would further submit, sir, in closing, that if you enact this bill or something similar, that would not have an effect on Turner, because Turner is well beyond that point, but it would apply to future jurisdictions, and we would support that motion.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. If you could go ahead very briefly, please, because we're going to need to move on. Go ahead.
Thank you. Roger Hamilton. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I had submitted written comments. I'm not going to read those. Mainly, I'll address a couple of the issues I think have been already brought up by Senator Whitsitt and others with respect to the current statute. I was a public utility commissioner in the state for 8 years. I was also, for 10 years actually, I was also Governor Kitzhaber's energy advisor. And probably most pertinent to this bill, I was the county commissioner when our land use code was adopted in Klamath County. If I had been county commissioner then, I can assure you that I would have certainly advocated and hopefully been successful in getting the county commission to rule on the land use issues here rather than the state. And that was the reason, that was how we sold the whole idea of the LCDC code to the county, was to guarantee that there would be local control over our land use and planning destiny. And to get to the planning issue, I don't agree with all of the comments of the
opponents. Have to tell you, I really, there's a whole room of people behind
right,
you
understand
to testify
that
on other bills. And
if I can just say this, Chair Ringo and Senator Barr, that it is... The problem with the current siting statute is willy-nilly, and we did this with our infatuation with electricity deregulation back in the 90s, willy-nilly we cite things without any alignment with Oregon energy policy, with state energy policy, or local land use, or local community aspirations. We have renewable energy policies, we have greenhouse gas reduction policies, we have rural economic development policies. In all of these cases, we don't look at the big picture. We would be citing renewable energy projects rather than natural gas projects if we did. And that's the short end of it. And in every attempt, and I share very wholeheartedly the frustration of the Whitsitts, the others that you have heard, the Brocks, and coming into a process. It's not that the process isn't thorough, but it's that at every occasion of raising issues of fundamental importance both to the local community and to Oregonians with respect to energy policy, these issues were ruled as irrelevant out of the jurisdiction of the state siting policy because they were taken care of by off-site mitigation or whatever. So I would appeal to you to take a good look at this bill. It's a great bill. Renewable energy advocates...
Mr. Hamilton, I need you to wrap up, please.
That's it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Ringo and Senator Beyer. I'm Lisa Arkin, and I'm very briefly going to outline the four provisions of this bill because no one's really done that yet, and that way you'll have a better understanding. Senate Bill 527 is an opportunity to move Oregon toward sound energy planning that respects Oregon's long history of local land use determination and simultaneously establishes a framework for long-term energy planning. Number one, this bill relates new energy facility siting with long-term energy planning, and it, dash three amendments, ask for the Department of Energy to convene a task force that will be then reporting back to a committee that you set up in the interim. So we want to involve the Department of Energy and all the players and move Oregon forward. This bill encourages better public participation. That's number two. It increases public and local government participation only in the land use portion of the siting process in consultation with the Energy Facility Siting Council. It's important to note that this bill does not change the current law that allows expedited review. So the council is still the sole decision maker in expedited review. The third provision of this bill coordinates information gathering on environment. This bill does not add one single new environmental regulation or constraint. It merely asks that the Department of Energy gather the information and present it to the public for their review. And last, the fourth one, it makes sure that when certification is sought, that the applicant provides documentation about their technical expertise, their financial soundness, and any information about fines or criminal penalties. Those are four very sensible provisions of this bill, and we hope to work with the Department of Energy in the future. In summary, there are many supporters of this bill, and I guess since I'm the only one from Lane County speaking, let me point out that attached to my written testimony, which goes into this in more detail, there's a letter from the Lane County Commissioners to Governor Kulongoski and to the Department of Energy, and I want to quote what they said. Quote, "Whatever the ultimate decision of the Siting Council, it must reflect the complete and faithful participation by local and state government. That participation validates the final outcome and reinforces confidence by citizens in the role and integrity of government."
So I need you to wrap up, please. Okay. Thank you very much. Well, we're going to go ahead and we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 527. Certainly, there's a lot more discussion to be done on that bill. To the audience, we're trying to do too much this morning, and one of these bills has to give. What I'm going to do is take Senate Bill 731 and roll it over to the next day, unless I see Representative Dingfelder come in, and then I may get her testimony briefly on that. Excuse me. All right, well, I've got two folks here on Senate Bill 593, Justin Martin and Cheryl, is it?
Human.
Are you going to be, you say 3 minutes? Okay, well, hang on go ahead and sit down, Representative Dingfelder. Just chatting with Justin Martin and Cheryl for a second. Are you going to be around tomorrow, or would that be inconvenient to testify tomorrow? I'm getting a shrug of the shoulders. We'll see. Go ahead. We're going to go ahead and open a public hearing then on Senate Bill 731. Go ahead, Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, and committee member. My name is Representative Jackie Dingfelder, and I represent House District 45 from Northeast Portland. Appreciate you holding a hearing on this very important bill this morning. And you should have, hopefully, both the bill and the dash ones in front of you, because I'm going to refer to both. Currently, there is no universal requirement in Oregon for people diverting public water to keep track of what they use. Water use measurement is not, nor has it ever been, required for the vast majority of water right holders in the state. In certain specific instances, the Water Resources Department requires individuals to install measuring devices for water withdrawals or diversions. However, this program is not widespread. And in fact, according to recent Water Resources Department information, only 8% of surface and groundwater rights are required to measure use. Now, this does account for approximately 46% of the total volume of water allocated in the state, but that still leaves over 50% of Oregon's water unmetered. And you will hear more today on the specifics of the water use measurement program from the Water Resources Department.
Well, we won't hear it today.
But tomorrow. So why is measuring our water important? Every water basin in Oregon is currently oversubscribed for at least 1 month during the year, and some basins are overappropriated year-round. This is similar to someone who keeps writing checks, although their checking account contains $0. The state of Oregon has allocated more water than we have in the public's water account. Also, I believe that water measurement is a fairness issue. Some water users in the state are required to measure their water, and other water users are not. If we had a better track record at measuring water use, we'd be much more aware of how much water we're using overall. We could increase efficiencies that could result in reduction of water used in every basin in the state. Ultimately, we could help improve stream flows for fish and other water needs such as irrigation, municipal water use, industrial, and commercial uses. Water measurement is a very prudent water management tool, especially in times of drought, as we will be facing this summer. So I think this is a very timely bill. In addition to the bill, you should have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you. These amendments codify a policy adopted by the Water Resources Commission in the year 2000, to increase water measurement and report statewide. Instead of creating a new program, I'm proposing through the Dash 1 amendments that we charge Water Resources Department with strengthening and expanding their current water measurement program and require the department to report back to the legislature on their progress at the end of next year, 2006. I do understand in these tough budgetary times that this is a start in the right direction, that it would be difficult to engage in a whole new comprehensive program. However, given the seriousness of the drought that we probably will be facing and are already facing in many watersheds around the state, measuring our water makes sense, and I look forward to working with all the interested parties on this bill as we move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee.
Thank you very much.
Any questions before? I know you're going to hear from some other folks today.
No, that'll be all. Senator Whitsitt, are you here on Senate Bill 731?
Yes, I am.
Okay. why don't you come forward, please? I am going to postpone the rest of the testimony on this bill until tomorrow. Can't help that, just because then I'm going to need to move on to the other bill. And Senator Whitsitt, just you can keep that in mind too. If you want to weigh in further on this hearing, we'll continue tomorrow. But if you'd like to today, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ringo, committee members, for the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsitt, Senate District 28. Senate Bill 731 creates a classical unfunded mandate. It creates a substantial increase in cost to irrigators for a practice that they currently employ. The initial investment for purchase and installation of a measuring device that will instantaneously measure rate of diversion and continuous record and continuously record the cumulative record of flow for either groundwater or surface water diversion is substantial. The maintenance of the device, as well as the record keeping and record submittal requirements, will create a significant ongoing expense. Currently, the rate of diversion of surface water is accurately monitored over weirs, as it has been for centuries. Groundwater rate of diversion is closely estimated by pumping capacity. Seasonal duty from either source is rarely exceeded. No demonstrated need for the quantification of water diversion has been established. The necessity to collect this data on the part of the Oregon Water Resources Department is unfounded. Irrigators and irrigation districts have endured and prospered for many decades without this detailed information. An existing water right is a private property right that is not subject to fees or taxes. Development of a universal system of quantifying the rate of diversion and seasonal duty would certainly create the necessary system to establish an enforceable irrigation water fee or tax. I urge you to recognize this unneeded and expensive requirement for what it is, a useless, unfunded mandate that will further stress our agricultural communities. Please return this bill to the bottom drawer where it belongs. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate some of the points you made, Senator Whitsitt. We constantly hear in other contexts how water is a rare commodity, and there is the organization Water for Life that has that concept built into its name, and it seems to me that we need to do a better job in ensuring that it's used as efficiently as possible, and that when we don't even measure it precisely, then it's difficult to manage it. So that's just, but there's going to be a lot more debate on this tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify one thing?
Sure.
For the record? And I'm not sure if the senator had a chance to look at the Dash 1 amendments, but I think the Dash 1 amendments address a lot of the concerns that were raised here as far as the funding. And I just want to clarify that many irrigation districts in the state already do measurement.
Okay.
You're going to hear from them later.
Well, we'll have further discussions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to continue the hearing then on Senate Bill 731 tomorrow. Let's open a hearing briefly on Senate Bill 593. Can you guys take care of this in 60 seconds or less? We'll do it. Each? Okay, each. Go the hard bargain.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of Defenders of Wildlife and the Nature Conservancy. I'm pleased to have with me Cheryl Hummond, who is a senior conservation incentive specialist. And we're here to urge your support on Senate Bill 593.
Where are you from, Ms. Hummond?
The Portland area.
You came down from Portland this morning?
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Go ahead.
Senate Bill 593 resolves a minor technical problem in current statutes. It allows landowners to enter into a conservation easement without being penalized with back taxes. Why this bill is needed is because landowners who want to protect their land under a conservation easement may inadvertently be subjected to tax penalties due to inconsistencies in current state law. This bill would have a very minor revenue impact, if any. Depending on circumstances of individual landowners, the revenue impact could be zero. And as I mentioned before, Cheryl's here. She's got a brief history of where we're at, and then she'll be available for questions.
Sorry to keep it so brief, but go ahead.
Thank you very much. My name is Cheryl Hummond, and I work for Defenders of Wildlife in the Portland area. And I wanted to just mention the history of this bill. In the 2001 legislative session, the legislature directed an interim work group on incentives to look at conservation incentive programs throughout the state of Oregon and try to come up with recommendations for how to improve them, in part to make them more effective for private landowners. And this bill is comes out of one of the recommendations from that interim work group, which met in 2002. And it's, as Justin said, it's a simple technical fix that provides more flexibility for both the conservation interests and also for private landowners, hoping to have as many tools available to them as possible.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Sorry to rush it. I'm hoping that we can get this passed out of the committee tomorrow.
Thank you.
Are you okay with this?
Do you have any questions for us?
Go ahead. I don't have any questions.
No, we better move on to the next bill. I really appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 593, and we'll roll over the work session until tomorrow on Senate Bill 593. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 659, and we only have 15 minutes left, and I apologize to all of those who are here to hear on this bill. And I guess I'd like to get some guidance from Leslie Lehman. If you had to choose two or three people to testify on this in the next 15 minutes, who's your designated hitter on this?
That's fine. Might as well go home.
Okay, well, come on up. Greg Miller.
Justification. Which one are we on now?
The Forest Resources.
Oh, 659er.
Yes.
Okay, so.
Carol's testimony.
And.
Okay. And I apologize to have to squeeze in like this. But we'll need to keep this to about 7 minutes to let the other side testify. So who wants to go first here?
Why don't you bring Carol?
Carol? We're fast.
Okay. Chairman Ringo and members of the committee, I'm Greg Miller, current chair of the Board of Directors for the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. This morning I've asked Carol Whipple, who is our board vice chair, and Dan Williams, who's our board's public representative, and Leslie Lehman, to come forward and join me today in responding to questions that we understand are being asked in light of Senate Bill 659. Dan's in the audience here, Joe from Eugene, and I want to pay him special recognition because, and also Carol, who drove up from Roseburg. It's unfortunate that we don't have enough time to, we ask these folks to come up here, and we don't have enough time to, to address this. So,
just to interject for a moment, we have to leave at 8:30 because I believe the next committee will be starting. But I'd be happy to meet with the folks, especially that drove up here after in my office.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to follow up with me.
Thank you. So, anyway, I'm going to cut right to the chase to give Leslie and Carol some time to speak. And Basically, in my testimony on the last page, what I'd like to draw to your attention is in 1991, when O3 was established, it was bipartisan support, had the support of the forests sector, the state's forest sector, and the Oregon legislature created the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. It's funded by a dedicated harvest tax on forest products producers, and I want to underscore that, the issue around forest products producers. The vote was 25-1 in the Democratic-controlled Senate, and it was 56-1 in the Republican-controlled House, and Governor Barbara Roberts signed this into law. I want to make two very important points. First, the producers who pay the harvest tax dedicated to O3 support it. The statute includes a provision for tax refunds, and we've received no such requests. The second, eliminating O3's funding, which is what Senate Bill 659 does, would not save the state any money that could be used for other needs. O3 is funded by a harvest tax dedicated solely for this purpose and receives no general fund dollars. The tax and dollars are currently funded that currently fund O3 would simply go away. In the 14 years that O3's been operating, the feedback on our work from state leaders and constituents has been overwhelmingly positive, so this bill comes to a complete surprise to us. So I'm going to turn this over to Carol, and then Leslie will close.
If I could just put a question, please. Right now the harvest tax goes to several different purposes. It goes to, I think, research at OSU. It goes to fighting fires. It goes to other areas, and it also goes to O3. Some of those other areas get general fund money, and this year we're looking at spending a significant amount of general fund money on fighting forest fires. My question is whether it wouldn't be a better priority to take the money that's currently going to O3 and using it for some of those other areas that are receiving general fund dollars, such as fighting fires.
That's a fair question. If the legislature wants to take up that issue in terms of how much you would like industrial and non-industrial landowners to contribute for fire funding, then there's a bill called House Bill 2327. That's over in the revenue side of the building. It's a tax increase, and that's where you need to start that conversation, and we're fully prepared to have that conversation.
Okay.
O3 is dedicated to forestry education based on sound science, and that is, and there's no general fund dollars associated with it, so
that's
the issue.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Whipple. Thank you for coming up for Roseburg, and I really do apologize for running out of time here.
Chairman Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Carol Whipple. I reside at 21755 Highway 138 West Elkton, and I'm owner of the Rocking Sea Ranch there. When I was appointed to the O3 Board of Directors in 2001, I was excited at the prospect of representing the interests of forest landowners, particularly family forest landowners like myself. I was impressed with the outstanding landowner education programs that O3 offers, most of them in partnership with Oregon State University and the Oregon Department of Forestry. I knew firsthand that this work was helping landowners practice better forestry. It was also providing us information about what Oregonians value about forests and what they expect from those of us who manage them. I believe that literally thousands of Oregon forest landowners are taking better care of their forest resources because of the support and training that O3 provides. And there are literally thousands of us, about 30,000 on the Department of Revenue tax roll. It would truly be a shame to lose this support, and it would be a setback to the progress we have seen toward building Oregon's reputation as a world leader in sustainable forest management. I've been particularly interested in relationships between forest management, including timber harvesting, and our state's water resources and the quality of our drinking water. I served under Governors Goldschmidt, Roberts, and Kitzhaber on the Oregon Environmental Quality Commission and represented the commission on the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board. I now serve as a member of the Umpqua Basin Watershed Council and am currently president of the Oregon Water Trust Board. I mention all of that to make the point that my work with O3 is every bit as important in informing the decisions we make about how to manage our great forest resources. O3's work has clearly helped bring Oregonians together to recognize and achieve a balance between environmental and economic benefits our forests provide. findings of a recent report from the National Commission on Science for Sustainable Forestry said it best, quote, the greatest threat to forest sustainability and biodiversity is conversion of forests to other land uses, unquote.
Well, that's our Measure 37 bill we're talking about now.
The private landowners who cannot earn a return on their forest land investment may be pressured to convert them to non-forest uses when their environmental contributions may be permanently lost. This is happening in neighboring states and even in parts of Oregon. OFRES, public landowner and landowner education work, is one of the best things we have going to reduce this threat. I consider OFRES' ongoing educational efforts to be crucial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Ms. Lehman, can we just meet afterwards? Would that be okay? Just because we have 5 minutes left, and I need to get folks on the other side have driven for some distance. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Marianne Guest, Chuck Wheeler, George Brown. And just to let the audience know, I won't be able to take any more testimony on this bill today. And I apologize to those who've waited in the audience. I know you got up early to do so. And we'll carry this over till tomorrow. There's really nothing I can do. We've just run out of time. Go ahead. And again, we only have about 4 minutes, so you're going to have to keep it brief.
I'll do probably 40 seconds.
Okay.
I'm Mary Ann Guest. Good morning, and I represent the Wild Salmon Center. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 2005, when money is really tight in the Oregon legislature, it may be time to reexamine the use of the Forest Products Harvest Tax for OFRE for education. Right now, there is a bill in Ways and Means, which Greg Miller referenced, House Bill 2327, which shifts some of the cost for fighting fires from private lands to the state general fund, and that's about $10 million. Right now, OFRE gets about $7 million, and we think that folks have to make tough decisions right now, and the decision for private landowners is do they want education or do they want forest protection from fires, and we think that an amendment to the bill to dedicate this tax to fighting fires on private lands is a prudent use of the legislature's decision-making authority, and that if they don't use the money, the $7 million, that money be in a reserve fund to continue to provide that protection in the future.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Chuck Wheeler, Director of the Coast Range Association.
Where are you from, Chuck?
Corvallis.
That's right.
Thanks. There has been a huge discussion within many environmental circles and in the general public about disappointment of OFRE's performance regarding its advertising campaign on Oregon forests. The reallocation of OFRE funding, we believe, would be warranted. It is a redundant institution relative to other institutions in the state, ODF or the School of Forestry. In times of tight funding, those other institutions could pick up its mission. But the key point that I'd like to emphasize in terms of where Oregon's resources are going is that OFRE is failing in its primary mission, which is general education of the public about forest issues. It is spending huge amounts of money on vacuous television advertising made by slick advertising agencies that convey no meaningful information to the public, and it does not play a productive role in that component of its work in advancing Oregon forestry. There is a huge unhappiness out in the public about those television commercials amongst people who have a serious concern about the nature of private forestry in Oregon. And that propaganda function needs to end, and the propaganda function can be traced right back to its governance structure and problems in that, the lack of accountability and the particular makeup of its board, which specifically, by statute, excludes environmental interests. And whether they need a wake-up call or whatever, but a reallocation of money would be a serious statement that in times of tough funding, we don't need redundant institutions that aren't serving its main mission. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Ward. Mr. Brown?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm George Brown, Dean Emeritus of the College of Forestry, Director Emeritus of the Forest Research Laboratory at Oregon State University. And it was my pleasure to serve by statute as an ex officio member of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute from its inception in 1991 to my retirement in 1999. And I come before you today really as a private citizen to urge you to vote against Senate Bill 659. O3 is doing exactly what this legislature asked it to do, and that is provide education. It has been a facilitator for education that could not otherwise have been done, because there are no state general fund monies, as you well know, to allow the university, to allow the Department of Forestry to provide these educational programs. And if you look at a list of what they have offered to citizens, to school teachers, a huge number of K-12 school teachers, it has been a remarkable experience. I cannot understand why you would want to eliminate, basically, a state agency that's doing such a remarkable job at no cost to the general fund, and they're doing precisely what you intended in 1991. We've got serious natural resources issues in this state that demand your attention, and I urge you to kill this bill in committee and get on with the truly critical issues that face our state. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your very straightforward testimony, Mr. Brown. Thank you for coming today. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just like to say I appreciate the proponents of the bill coming forward and trying to determine that they want to raise my taxes because they don't pay these taxes, and they would like to reallocate the money that I have chosen to give to this purpose, because, as was testified, none of the producers have ever asked for a refund, which is allowed by state law. Thank you.
Well, Senator Beyer, there's a certain sentiment out there that we've quit taxing timber in this state, and that how we tax it goes to support the industry and not the public and not schools and not public purposes. And that's a whole other debate and a whole other committee.
Yes, it is.
Thank you very much. And let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 659. Again, I apologize to the folks who didn't get a chance to testify today, and the committee is adjourned.